from victory to victory, from giant killing to giant killing, and fail to recognize that the majority of David's 10 years in the wilderness were spent alone, in solitude, nights under the starry sky, sleeping in caves, wandering from place to place, living anything but the life of a king. Half of the Psalms that were written are Psalms of lament. Not Psalms of praise and joy, but Psalms of pain and sorrow. Because oftentimes following God leads us into difficult places. And the plea, God, are you small enough to be with me now? Are you there? Are you listening? Are you present? That was David's request. God, show up. Show me your face. Show me a sign. You know, it's easy to find God when we're standing on the mountaintop and everything's going our way. It's easy to claim God's presence in the midst of victory. But it's very hard to manufacture the presence of God in the wilderness. And what happens when you find yourself in the wilderness and all of a sudden an incredible opportunity comes your way to step from problems into prosperity? When you have the opportunity to take advantage of a situation that will propel you past all of your problems and what seems like the perfect solution, what do you do then? Well, David had that opportunity, and we're going to look at it this morning in 1 Samuel chapter 24, and then in 1 Samuel chapter 26, and I'd love for you to turn to your Bibles there. As we look at opportunity knocks, David has a chance to solve all of his problems, and I want you to see what happens in David's life. If you had the solution to your problem today, what would you do with it? Chapter 24, verse 1 says, after Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert in En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Now David's got about 600 guys with him. They're the rabble, the ragtag guys, the guys that were in debt, distressed. He's whipped them into a little military force, but Saul picks 3,000 of the choicest soldiers from all over Israel. So David is really outnumbered 5-1. And Saul's chasing him. He's in the desert, in the wilderness, in En-Gedi. Actually, it's up in the rocks in that area. And he's hiding out there, and Saul's coming to get him. Now, notice verse 3. I love the Bible. Look here. He says, he came to the sheep pens, that's Saul, along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Nature calls, even for kings. Saul goes into the cave to get a little privacy. And when he goes into the cave, guess what happens? Incredible story. David and his men were far back in the cave. This was one of those caves that you go in, and inside there must have been a huge cavernous area, but it was down in there deep enough to where Saul didn't realize that there was anybody in the cave. And so he goes in there for a little private business, and guess who's way back in the cave? Saul thinks he's getting some privacy, but he's just walked into the worst situation he could have ever imagined. So, verse 4, the men said, notice what they say, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. What an opportunity. I mean, Saul's been chasing David. Saul's been trying to kill David. 6 times Saul has tried to kill David up to this point. He's been chasing him through the desert. David knows that he's going to be king. God's promised that he's going to sit on the throne. The only obstacle between he and the throne is Saul. And Saul, this murderous, angry, evil man, is right there as vulnerable as you could possibly be. And all of David's men say to him, hey, here's your opportunity. It's ordained of God. The only way that this would have ever worked out, that Saul would come into a cave to put himself in this awkward position and us be in the way, is if God was doing this. There's no other way this could have ever happened. So what does David do? Verse 5 says, excuse me, end of verse 4 says, then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And then his reaction afterwards, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe, and he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." And with these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul, and Saul left the cave and went his way. Opportunity knocks. His men say, "Go kill him." David not only doesn't kill him, but he also keeps his men from killing him, and he tells them, "This is wrong. This isn't God's plan. This isn't God's will. I'm not going to take advantage of Saul." And Saul gets away, and David is left with a corner of his robe. The word rebuke there in that verse literally means that he tore into them. It's the same word that's used in Isaiah 53 when it says that Jesus was torn into on the cross, or wounded on the cross. David rebuked his men harshly. He literally took them apart for even considering killing Saul as an option for their problems. And then David confronts Saul. Notice what he says to him. Verse 8 says, "Then David went out of the cave and called to Saul." The implication of the word called is that he let Saul get quite a ways away, so he had to go out and yell for Saul to be able to hear him. And he calls out to Saul, and notice what he says. He says, "My lord the king." When Saul looked around behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. And he said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed." Now I want you to notice David's argument to Saul. First of all, he says to Saul, "If you think that I'm going to listen to the voice of other people, if you think that I'm going to be incited to kill you based on what people are telling me, I can tell you that right off the bat, I'm not going to do that. My men think you ought to be dead right now. But I'm not going to listen to the advice of even my closest confidants when they tell me to do something that I know I shouldn't do." Secondly, he reminds Saul of their relationship. Look in the next verse, he says in verse 11, "See, my father, look at the piece of your robe." Now, why does David call Saul his father? Two reasons. Number one is that was a term of submission. But secondly, Saul is his father-in-law. And he's reminding Saul, "Hey, we have a relationship here." Third, David says, "I want you to see with your own eyes the physical evidence of my loyalty." Notice in verse 11, he says, "See, my father, look at this piece of robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. Now understand and recognize that I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life." And then fourthly, David appeals to the true judge. Notice in the next verse, he says in verse 12, "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. No matter what you do to me, I'm not going to retaliate." And then he says in verse 13, as the old saying goes, "From evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you." Then David says, "Saul, you better watch out." Notice in verse 14, he says, "Against whom has the king of Israel come out?" "Who do you think I am, Saul?" He says, Who are you pursuing? "A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." Now David makes this cryptic remark, which commentators have struggled with, and some have said, well, David was being diminutive. You know, "I'm only a flea, I'm only a dog. Why would the king of Israel mess with me?" I don't believe that's what David is saying. I believe David is saying exactly the opposite. David is saying, "Saul, don't you understand that I'm protected by God? Don't you remember Goliath? You're smaller than him, right? In fact, you were scared to fight him. You're out here in the desert pursuing me. You're out here trying to kill me. And do you think I'm as small as a flea or some little dog that you can kick around?" The implication is that David understands that part of the reason why he's in the desert is for Saul's protection. He's in the desert for Saul's protection because if it ever came down to a confrontation between David and Saul, David is completely confident that he would win. And even though he's running for his life, he also recognizes that in the sovereign hand of God, that he is not a nobody, that God is going to protect him, that God is going to care for him, and God is going to make sure that he ends up on the throne. And you know what? Saul recognizes it too. Notice what he says in latter verses here. He says in verse 16, when David finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me of the good you did to me. The Lord delivered you, delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today." Verse 20, "I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. Opportunity knocks. David passes it up. Guess what? Opportunity will knock again. Turn to chapter 26. We'll come back and discuss chapter 25 in a couple weeks, but I want you to notice what happens in chapter 26. Guess where Saul ends up in chapter 26? Saul comes to pursue David again. Saul, who has acknowledged that David will end up on the throne, is out there looking for him with his 3,000 chosen men, prepared to kill David again. And David is going to get a second chance. Interestingly enough, as you begin to read chapter 26, you find out in the chapter that Saul, as he comes out to look for David, he is placed in a position of strength. When it comes time to go to bed at night, Saul lays down, and right next to him is his chief soldier, Abner, captain of the bodyguard, the commander of the military forces, his strong man, who sleeps right beside him. You'll also notice as you read it that Saul's spear is located right beside his head. Saul never got within longer than an arm's distance from being able to grab a hold of his spear. In addition to that, it tells us that the camp of Israel is circled all the way around him, and so all the soldiers are lined up in a military circle around him as they rest for the night. And guess what David decides to do? David decides to pay a little visit to Saul in the night. And we'll pick up with verse 7. So David and Abishai, one of his men, went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. So David sneaks into the camp at night. And Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands." Same thing. Man, here we are, we're standing here, there's Saul snoring. He's right there. Now, the last time David saw him, Saul was doing something else. Now he's got him when he's sleeping. Spear right beside him. And what does Abishai say? Abishai says, "This is God. There's no way we could have gotten here. There's no way we could be in this situation if God hadn't orchestrated it." And notice what Abishai says. He says, "Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice." In other words, I won't miss. Just give me a shot at him. I won't miss. Interestingly enough, the translation says, "Let me strike him with my spear." But in the original Hebrew, there's no "my" in the text. It literally says, "Let me strike him with the spear." And I believe a better translation or a better understanding is, he's saying, "Let me take Saul's spear and let me strike him with Saul's spear, with the spear, and I won't have to do it twice." He's ready to go. He's ready to take Saul out. And wouldn't it be amazing to have the opportunity for the spear that now three times Saul has thrown at David to try to pin him to the wall? Now, David has the opportunity with that very same spear to literally pin Saul to the ground. What's David's response? "But David said to Abishai, 'Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives,' he said, 'the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and the water jug that are near his head, and let's go.'" And so they picked up the spear, they picked up the water jug, and they left Saul there. David again tells his men, I'm not going to do the wrong thing in order to accomplish the right ends. I'm not going to solve my problem by becoming what Saul is. And so they leave with a water jug. Well, the story goes on to say that when they get across the ravine and get a ways away where they are protected, that David begins to call back to Abner, Saul's captain of his bodyguard. And as he's yelling back to Abner, he basically calls Abner incompetent, and he basically calls him a coward, because it was Abner's responsibility to protect Saul's life, and he didn't do it. What David is pointing out to Saul is that even the strongest military man that you have cannot keep you from coming under the judgment of God if God chooses to take you out. Saul begins to reply back to David. And then finally David says in verse 22, here's the king's spear, David answered. Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I value your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all my trouble. Then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph. So David went on his way and Saul returned home. And this would be the last meeting between David and Saul. Now before we get to application, there's one other thing I want to point out to you. In these two encounters, David has the opportunity to take out his problem by doing something that he shouldn't do, kill Saul. What happens at the first encounter, when the first encounter is over? Saul passes on to David the birthright. Remember, Saul says, David, you surely will be king. He passes on to David the birthright. So David gives up an opportunity to kill Saul and receives from Saul the right to be the next king. In the second situation, David's faced with an opportunity to kill Saul again. He does not take it. And what does Saul give him? Saul gives him the blessing. In both cases, David does not choose to take matters into his own hands. And in both cases, from the man right now that's trying to take his life, he receives some kind of special blessing that will pass on into his kingdom, something that he would have never received any other way. Now, I want us to focus on some application to the story, because there's so many parallels between this situation and the opportunities that come our way. And when we look at our story, I want to begin by pointing out that opportunities to advance our cause don't always come from God. Opportunities to advance our cause don't always come from God. You know, we got lots and lots of quaint sayings, you know, when God closes a door, he opens a window, and lots of stuff like that. And oftentimes we have the tendency that when we see something before us that appears to be the solution to our problem, or we see something before us that appears to be something we want, we have a tendency to credit that to God. And sometimes it's not from God. Do you think that every temptation that Satan puts before you will always appear to be something that's bad? Or do you think Satan can lay before you opportunities that really look good and appealing, and yet it's the worst possible thing that could happen? In both of these cases, David's men see the opportunity to take Saul's life as a blessing from God. This is from God. This is a chance. This is what we've been waiting for. And can you imagine the peer pressure? These guys hate Saul. Saul's been trying to kill them. They're living out in the desert because of Saul. They're living in the caves. They're trying to survive, living off whatever they can scrounge together. Their life is miserable. And they hate Saul. They want him out of there. They put all kinds of pressure on David, and David holds them back. You know, one of the reasons why I believe that oftentimes that we mistake opportunities for the will of God is because we are so focused on results. What's the end? What do we want? What do we desire? And if we can just get results, who cares what it takes to get them? I had some interaction with a guy who was struggling with a problem at work, and he got a note from a supplier that he was dealing with. And this supplier, I mean, it was very rude what the guy said. In fact, I'll quote you the email. He said to him, he said, you people are stupid, rude, ignorant, and short. I guess this guy's tall. He said, it has taken me 2 weeks to get a scheduled ship date on a project, and my customer is furious. I have never seen such incompetence. As far as I am concerned, I will never sell this product again. So that's what my friend gets back from somebody that he's doing business with. Stupid, rude, ignorant, and short. So he takes this, my friend takes this, and he emails the situation to the president of his company, which, by the way, is over $1 billion a year company, emails it to him because he wants to keep him informed if somebody's mad about something that happened, and he wants to let him know that, they've resolved the problem. And so he forwards this particular paragraph of the email, and he also goes on to say, to explain to his boss, he said, "I am sure you will be hearing about this if you haven't already seen it. I spoke to the agent and apologized, and we have resolved the problem. This guy is obviously bulletproof to write something like this. In my 15 years in the business, I have never seen anything so hateful." So he tells his boss, and this is his response to his boss, and his boss responds back with these words, "If the shoe fits, question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark." And then the boss goes on to say, "By the way, nobody is bulletproof, but remember, dot, 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 I worship at the altar of results." Now here's what the boss is saying. Listen, I don't care what happens. As long as I'm making money, as long as my company is successful, if people treat you rudely, I don't care. If you have to deal with people that are egomaniacs, I don't care. If you don't do your job in such a way that it makes me successful, I don't even care about you. There's nobody bulletproof around here. Relationships don't mean anything to me. Ethics don't mean anything to me. But one thing means something to me. I worship at the altar of results. Now, all of that sounds real good. But when you start applying that to life, people go to the very bottom of the priority. These guys saw the opportunity to get good results. Let's take them out. Let's take Saul out. "You'll be king then, David." And David says, "No, I'm not going to do this. Just because the results may produce an end that you desire does not mean that you should pursue that course of action." And the number of times that people have blamed God, you know, "Well, God gave me this opportunity, and that's why I took it, and now the result of that is broken lives and broken people, but, you know, God gave me this opportunity." The number of people that come to me and tell me that they're about to commit a sin because God provided the opportunity for them to do that, I mean, it's overwhelming. It's amazing. How many opportunities over the course of your life have you seen that would advance something that you wanted, even though you knew that you would have to compromise to achieve those? Which leads to our second application from this passage, and that is that my behavior must always be based on character, not circumstances. My behavior must always be based on character, not circumstances. I want you to turn back to chapter 25 and look at a few of the words that David says in verses 12 and 13. Verse 12 and 13 of chapter 25, David says, "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so that my hand will not touch you." Now here's what David is saying. Got to follow this somewhat sophisticated line of thinking. What David is saying is that people have told you, Saul, that I'm going to try to kill you. And so because you don't think that that's right and you don't want to be killed, you know what you've decided to do? You've decided to kill me. Now, if I operated on your justice system, then what I would do is say, well, if you're trying to kill me, then I'm going to kill you. And so I would have killed you. I would have taken your life. But David says, I don't operate on that system. The reason why I don't operate on that system is because of who I am. From evildoers comes evil deeds. And what David is saying is, if I were to kill you, even though you're trying to kill me, if I were to take advantage of the opportunity and kill you, then I would be just like you. And I don't want to be just like you. Evildoers do evil things, and I'm not an evildoer, so I'm not going to take your life regardless of what you're trying to do to me. You see, what he's struggling with is a very bad case of what we call circumstantial ethics. Circumstantial ethics. David's trying to take my throne, that's my circumstance. David's trying to take my place, and so what do I need to do? I need to kill David. David, on the other hand, is operating on the basis of character ethics. I don't care what the circumstances are. I don't care what Saul is trying to do to me. I'm not going to take his life. Here's the problem with operating on circumstantial ethics, where my circumstances determine my behavior. The problem is that when you operate on the basis of circumstantial ethics, you will often become what you hate the most. You'll often become what you hate the most. For the person who says, you know, people abused me, and so, you know, that's why I just can't control my anger, and you know, I know sometimes I'm abusive, but it's because people abused me. Now, what is that? My circumstances, what somebody did to me, somehow that allows me the freedom to turn around and do that to somebody else, but you know what? I hate what people did to me. I hate that. But then I turn around and excuse it and become what I hate the most. Someone cheats me. I hate to be cheated. So you know what I do? I turn around and I use that as an excuse to cheat someone else. And you know what I'm becoming? I'm becoming exactly what I hate the most. It's the kick the dog syndrome, you know? Boss kicks you at work, and you come home and you kick your spouse, and then your spouse kicks the kid, and then the kid goes and kicks the dog. It's, my boss treated me so bad. He was so mean. She was so mean to me at work today. So I'm going to somehow come home and allow those circumstances to give me the freedom to become exactly what I hate. And in this case, David's saying, from evildoers come evil deeds, and since I'm not that character, that's not who I am, I'm not an evil person, I'm not going to allow Saul's murderous rage, Saul's jealousy, Saul's attempt to take my life to turn me into what Saul is. And any time you let circumstances determine your behavior, well, because this happened to me, therefore, or because people are doing this to me, then I can, or because at work they do these things to me, so therefore I can turn around and... No. Anytime you do that, you become the very thing that you say you hate. Circumstances don't determine behavior. Character does. And David says, I'm not a murderer. I'm not an evildoer. And so I'm not going to take Saul's life, regardless of what happens. You see, my behavior must be based on my character, not on my circumstances. Calvin deals with this in a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. I'll put it up here for you to follow along. He's wrestling with a dilemma, and he's talking to his tiger about it, and he says, today at school, I tried to decide whether to cheat on my test or not. I wondered, is it better to do the right thing and fail, or is it better to do the wrong thing and succeed? On the one hand, undeserved success gives no satisfaction, but on the other hand, well-deserved failure gives no satisfaction either. Makes sense. Of course, most everyone cheats sometime or other. People always bend the rules if they think they can get away with it. Then again, that doesn't justify my cheating. Then he gets philosophical. Then I thought, look, cheating on one little test isn't such a big deal. It doesn't hurt anyone. But then I was wondering if I was just rationalizing my unwillingness to accept the consequences of not studying. Still, in the real world, people care about success, not principles. Then again, maybe that's why the real world is such a mess. What a dilemma. And finally, Hobbes asked the question, so what did you decide? Calvin, nothing. I ran out of time and had to turn in a blank paper. And Hobbes says, any more, simply acknowledging the issue is a moral victory. And then Calvin reveals the real truth. He says, well, it just seemed wrong to cheat on an ethics test. The great theologian John Calvin and the philosopher Hobbes getting together in the comics, just dealing with real life. I mean, the bottom line is that the majority of the people in your life are going to operate on circumstantial ethics. They will make their mind up what they will do on a day-to-day basis based on what's going on around them. And I believe that that is why people are so miserable, because we hate what we become, and yet we excuse it because we're just doing what we need to do to survive in the circumstances. And very few people actually lay their head down on their pillow at night and say, you know, my character was consistent throughout the day. I lived a consistent life regardless of what happened. That was the life of David. Finally, our last point of application is that the wilderness is both a dangerous and a wonderful place. The wilderness is both a dangerous and a wonderful place. David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. There's an oasis there in En-Gedi that provides the water for him to survive, but it's there by the Dead Sea. It's a barren land, rocky crags, lots of caves, limestone formation. It's a scary place, and to think that David was living out there and trying to survive out there with his men, that was a very hard place to be. Now, David was in the wilderness not because he chose to be there, but because he was forced to be there because of his conflict with Saul. And I believe that every single person on the face of the earth is going to go through wilderness experiences. And most of the time, it's not because we desire to. Most of the time, it's a circumstantial wilderness where problems arise in our life, where things fall apart, where a spouse walks out the door, or we get laid off from our jobs, or where we find out that our child's been experimenting with drugs, or where we get a bad report from the doctor and we begin to feel the pain of crumbling health. And it's during those dangerous times, during those times when life seems to be really bad, that if you look carefully, you can see God doing some incredible things. I want you to notice that in the life of David, in the midst of his wilderness experience, where he's writing his laments to God, he's also finding God everywhere he looks. Everywhere David turns, he's seeing the hand of God. In fact, David sees God in the most unbelievable place. When his men say, take Saul out, you know what David says? David says, how can I raise my hand against the Lord's anointed? David sees God in Saul. The most godless character in the story. And David can even see God in Saul. In fact, David says, listen, maybe Saul's out here pursuing me because God sent him after me. Maybe this was divinely orchestrated for some positive reason. Now, how does David see God in Saul? How do you see God in the person that just fired you? How do you see God in the person that just tore your heart out and stepped on it and walked away? Well, you start by recognizing that in those hard times, in the wilderness, in difficult places, that God is there. God is present. I don't know exactly why, but I think for men, maybe the hardest thing to face is the possibility of financial disaster or career setbacks. And you know, we're in a time right now with our economy that the stock market doesn't look real good, and companies are talking about layoffs, and people are scared about that. And that's a dangerous time. It's a dangerous place. And yet, in the midst of that dangerous time and in the midst of that struggle, I would encourage you that that wilderness time is also a place to find God and to see God doing some incredible things. I seldom talk about this. Probably the hardest 6 months to a year and a half of my life was right after I finished pastoring my first church. I started a church with a group of 13 families in Ruston, Louisiana, and pastored it for about 3 years. We hired a co-pastor 9 months into it, very gifted individual, and within about a year, it was very clear to me that he and I had completely different philosophies of ministry. We were going in two completely different directions, and we went to our elders and we said, guys, can you solve this problem? And they said, no, we don't know what to do. You guys went to seminary. You ought to be able to figure it out. And, you know, at 26, 27 years old, I guess I was at the time, I didn't have a clue as to what to do. And so we brought in a consultant, one of those guys that corporations pay $6,000 a day to, and he did his cut-rate charity deal and only charged us $1,000 a day. And he got there, did a personality test, and brought the results back of the personality test, and he said, well, here's your two choices, gentlemen. If you pick Tim, what you're going to get in a church, because the church is going to take on the characteristics of his pastor, what you're going to get in a church is you're going to get a church that's very theological, very cold, very calculating, very analytical, and, you know, people just aren't going to feel the presence of God based on a personality test. Now, I know I've got a bad personality, but that was pretty strong. And this other guy, he's warm and loving and caring, so if you want a place where people feel the presence of God, you know, he can build a church like that. And, of course, that put the elders in a pretty tough spot. But after prayer, they decided that, you know, the best thing that could happen would be for me to go one way and him to stay there. So that's what we decided to do. So, you know, first time in my life, you know, I'd lost a job. Everything I'd done up to that point, I would get promoted all the time. And, you know, here I was, you know, my $27,000 a year salary was going to be zero. And it was just an incredibly difficult time. And during that time, I grew more than I could ever imagine. You know, trying to figure out how I'm going to feed the family. You know, where's the next meal going to come from? I had to learn to trust God. I had to look for God's hand in things that were beyond my ability. Really wrestling with the things that were said about me and my gifting. Do I quit? Do I change directions? Do I do something different? And really having to wrestle with, does God have a call on my life? Seeing the value of friendship, which honestly, at that point in my life, I really did not value people. But recognizing that in a place of brokenness that I needed advice, I needed feedback, I needed somebody to mentor me, someone to help me to know what to do next. And I learned the value of people during that time. The next 6 months were the bleakest, darkest, hardest days of my life. And then I came to Austin, Texas, to Hill Country Bible Church. And I found guys like Don Cunningham, who had also gone through a wilderness experience when the bottom fell out of the market here in Austin in the early 80s, and his engineering firm went from 165 people down to just a handful of people, and he lost millions of dollars, and yet stayed with it, paid off all of his debts as he could. And he and I, we were two broken guys going through a desert together, and God sustained us. The other day I was talking to a fellow, and he said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to get laid off in this batch of layoffs or not, but he said, everybody I know that has ever been laid off tells me that's the best thing that ever happened to him. And he said, so I'm kind of jealous. In the midst of the wilderness, if you look, you see God doing wonderful things, changing your heart. And when David can look at Saul and say, he is the Lord's anointed, and see God in Saul, David can see God everywhere. And that comes from being faithful in the wilderness. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, as we come before you today, we just recognize that you are good and that you are never far away. And that if we open our eyes, we can see you in our circumstances. Father, give us the courage not to jump at every little opportunity that presents itself, but to carefully discern your will and to grow as we build our character and as we learn in the desert places of our lives. Father, may it be the wilderness of our lives, may that be a place of growth, a place of joy, a place of peace. May we be like David, who sees you in everything. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.